Prani Kija.
Jai.
Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda Kija.
Jai.
Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutai. Srimate Bhakti Vinata Swami Niti. Namaste Saraswati Devi. Gauravani Pachana Nivasasa Sangani Paskacharya Satare. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Parakamma. Sri Guru Vaishnavascha. Sri Rupam Sagujatam Sagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajiva. Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lavita Sri Vishakam Vitam Stam. Panchakalpa Chubhistaki Vasindhavya Vitapitam Pavani Vivaishnavya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 December 14th, 2013, in Dallas, Texas, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 52, Rukmini's Message to Krishna, Texts 5 through 11. Text 5. Bhagavan Punar Avrajya.
Bhagavan Punar Avrajya.
Gurim Yavana Veshtitam.
Gurim Yavana Veshtitam.
Hatvam Lecha Balam Ninye.
Hatvam Lecha Balam Ninye.
Tadiyam Dwark. Dwarakam Ganam.
Dhaniyam Dwarakam Ganam.
Please chant.
Bhagavan Punar, Bhagavan Punar Avrajya.
Bhagavan Punar Avrajya.
Gurim Yavana Veshtitam.
Gurim Yavana Veshtitam.
Atva Milecha Balam Ninye.
Atva Milecha Balam Ninye.
Dhaniyam Dwarakam Ganam.
Dhaniyam
Avrajya,
returning,
Purim,
to his city,
Yavana,
by the Yavanas,
Veshtitam,
surrounded,
Hatva,
killing,
Mlecha, of barbarians,
Balam,
the army,
Ninye,
he brought,
Tadiyam,
there,
Dwarakam,
to Dwaraka,
Dhanam,
wealth. So Krishna's killed Kalyavana, and now, translation purport, the Lord returned to Mathura, which was still surrounded by Yavanas. Then he destroyed the army of barbarians and began taking their valuables to Dwarka. So the soldiers in former times used to wear a lot of wealth. They used to have helmets with jewels in them. It wasn't just like, you know, now you have night goggles or something on your but they had valuable jewels, and their armor was often made of valuable metals, and also the decorations on their horses and elephants were very valuable. And one of the things you got if you defeated the army was you got to take your wealth back to your own city. So purport. It is clear from this verse that Kalyavana alone pursued Lord Krishna into the mountain cave. When Krishna returned to the besieged city of Mathura, he eliminated the vast barbarian army. Text 6. As the wealth was being carried by oxen and men under Lord Krishna's direction, Jarasandha appeared at the head of 23 armies. So this was 18th time, I think, he's attacking Krishna. Text 7. O king, seeing the fierce waves of the enemy's army, the two Madhavas, imitating human behavior, ran swiftly away. So every other time they had fought with Jarasandha. And they had fought with him so severely, they had defeated every single member of his army except for him. And they had made rivers of blood in which the pieces of the bodies of the men and the animals were floating. And Jarasandha kept coming back and kept coming back and kept coming back. And this time, they didn't find him. Text 8. Abandoning the abundant riches, fearless but feigning fear, they went many yojanas on their lotus-like feet. Text 9. When he saw them fleeing, powerful Jarasandha laughed loudly and then pursued them with charioteers and foot soldiers. He could not understand the exalted position of the two lords. He thought, oh, now this time they're afraid of me. This time I'm winning. You know, like the gambler who loses and loses but keeps hoping they're going to win. Text 10. Apparently exhausted after fleeing a long distance, the two lords climbed a high mountain named Pravarshana, upon which Lord Indra showers incessant rain. Text 11. Although he knew they were hiding on the mountain, Jarasandha could find no trace of them. Therefore, O king, he placed firewood on all sides and set the mountain ablaze. Purport. Clearly, we are observing one of the Supreme Lord's transcendental pastimes. Although the Bhagavatam states that the two lords, Krishna and Balaram, were, quote, exhausted, unquote, even in their so-called exhausted state, they were able to quickly climb a high mountain and shortly thereafter jump off it to the ground. It would be unwise and illogical to ignore the whole picture the sages are giving us here and instead try to pick apart isolated descriptions. So in other words, if you just say, well, Bhagavatam says they were exhausted, and you ignore the fact that in their so-called exhausted state they climbed a mountain and jumped off of it, then you're not going to get the whole picture. Clearly, we are watching the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the midst of his spiritual pastimes. We are not observing an ordinary human being. Lord Krishna and Lord Balaram were still quite young men when this pastime took place. One can easily see in these descriptions how they must have been enjoying themselves, eagerly fleeing from the somewhat ridiculous King Jarasandha, racing up a mountain, jumping off, and totally befuddling the constantly failing demon, who somehow or other never lost confidence in himself. Seen without envy or quarrelsomeness, the Lord's pastimes are immensely entertaining. I'm going to read the corresponding section in Krishna Book. Lord Krishna also returned to the vicinity of the city of Mathura and began to fight with the soldiers of Kalyavana and kill them one after another. After this, he collected all the booty from the dead bodies, and under his direction it was loaded on bullock carts by big men and brought back to Dwarka. So here Prabhupada just said it was brought back to Dwarka. Whether it's directing the Bhagavatam, it's not clear because Krishna and Balaram leave the booty. So you're not sure, you know, does it make it to Dwarka or not without them, but Prabhupada says it went back to Dwarka. Meanwhile, Jarasandha again attacked Mathura, this time with bigger divisions of soldiers, numbering 23 Akshahinis. Lord Sri Krishna wanted to save Mathura from the 18th attack of the great military divisions of King Jarasandha. In order to prevent further killing of soldiers and to attend to other important business, Lord Krishna left the battlefield without fighting. Actually, he was not at all afraid, but he pretended to be an ordinary human being, frightened by the immense quantity of soldiers and resources of Jarasandha. Without any weapons, he left the battlefield. Although his lotus feet were as soft as the petals of the lotus flower, he proceeded for a very long distance on foot. This time, Jarasandha thought that Krishna and Balaram were very much afraid of his military strength and were fleeing from the battlefield. He began to follow them with all his chariots, horses, and infantry. So that's not good. Because the Vedic idea of fighting is that you fight on an equal basis. So if Krishna and Balaram are going alone and without weapons and without a chariot and they're walking, Jarasandha has no business following them with chariots and his whole army. He really should have, if anything, he should have engaged them to a one-on-one duel, which is what Kalyavana did. When Krishna left and Kalyavana followed him, Kalyavana, who's the barbarian, had more proper behavior than Jarasandha, who is a Vedic king. So interesting. But of course, this was Krishna's device. Prabhupada says he wanted to save Mathura from another battle. So he was drawing, he knew that Jarasandha would do this, so he was drawing Jarasandha's army away. He thought Krishna and Balaram to be ordinary human beings, and he was trying to measure the activities of the Lord. Krishna is known as Ranchur, which means, quote, one who has left the battlefield, unquote. In India, especially in Gujarat, there are many temples of Krishna, which are known as temples of Ranchurji. Ordinarily, if a king leaves a battlefield without fighting, he is called a coward. But when Krishna enacts his pastime, leaving the battlefield without fighting, he's worshipped by the devotee. A demon always tries to measure the opulence of Krishna, whereas a devotee never tries to measure his strength and opulence, but always surrenders unto him and worships him. By following the footsteps of pure devotees, we can know that Krishna, the Ranchurji, did not leave the battlefield because he was afraid, but because he had some other purpose. The purpose, as it will be revealed, was to attend to a confidential letter sent by Rukmini, his future first wife. The act of Krishna's leaving the battlefield is a display of one of his six opulences. Krishna is the supreme powerful, the supreme wealthy, the supreme famous, the supreme wise, the supreme beautiful. Similarly, he is the supreme renouncer. Srimad Bhagavatam clearly states that he left the battlefield in spite of having ample military strength. After all, he just defeated the barbarian army completely. Even without his militia, however, he alone would have been sufficient to defeat the army of Jarasandha, as he had done 17 times before. Therefore, his leaving the battlefield is an example of the supermost opulence of
renunciation.
After traversing a very long distance, the brothers pretended to become very tired. To mitigate their weariness, they climbed up a very high mountain, several miles above sea level. This mountain is called Pravarshana due to constant rain. The peak was always covered with clouds sent by Indra. Jarasandha took it for granted that the two brothers were afraid of his military power and had hidden themselves at the top of the mountain. So Jarasandha was making an assumption. And he was making an assumption based on his own way of thinking. His way of thinking is, if I ran away like that, I would be a coward, so anybody who runs away must be a coward. And as long as we're conditioned souls, we interpret what we see according to our own inner biases. He doesn't try to find out the reality of the situation. He has his own interpretation. He assumes that his interpretation is correct. First, he tried to find them, searching for a long time, but when he failed, he decided to trap and kill them by setting fires around the peak. He therefore surrounded the peak with oil and set it on fire. Of course, the next thing is going to be them jumping from the mountain, and we have this painting. Mm-hmm. So we're not reading those verses today, but we have this painting of Krishna and Balaram jumping from the mountain. So sometimes Krishna displays pure power, and other times he displays. Our understanding of God is not that God is just simply exhibiting just unmitigated raw power. God is very playful. Play is more pleasure than power. Play is more pleasure than power. Play is more pleasure than power. Therefore, we say Krishna is true Bhagavan Swami. Krishna in his original abode, Goloka Vrindavan, doesn't exhibit much power at all. It's all play. It's all krida. You know, on the earth planet, even Krishna is exhibiting power, but all that power is said to be exhibited through his Vasudeva expansion. I mean, Krishna likes being the powerful Narayana, flying through space, standing on the bank of a huge eagle, and smashing all the demons. But his ultimate pleasure is play. Play is more pleasure, power. So we all want to experience the highest pleasure and the greatest opulence. Everybody is looking for that. Talking the other day also how Prabhupada, in the preface to the Nectar Devotion and in his lectures on the preface, he talks a lot about how everyone's trying to enjoy one of the rasas. Anything we do is trying to enjoy some rasa. We're trying to enjoy some rasa and we're trying to enjoy some opulence. If you look at any of our motives for anything that anybody does, that is the motive. So if we really want to enjoy all the different rasas and we really want to enjoy all the different opulences, we need to join Krishna's pastimes, where he has everything, all varieties of play, more pleasurable than just simply exhibiting power. So looking at my own life, I can see that I'm interested in all of these things. I'm interested in beauty, I'm interested in strength and health, I'm interested in wealth, I'm interested in knowledge, I'm interested in wisdom, and I'm interested in renunciation. Can't we see this in our own lives? Aren't we interested in these things? Either for ourselves or to appreciate in others? And we're all trying to enjoy these rasas. One of the mistakes that devotees make, or anyone trying to better themselves, is... Thank you. Is sometimes we're doing something that we don't like. If we find ourselves engaging in some activity or not that we don't want to do, or not engaging in activity that we say we do want to do, if there's a disconnect between what we say we want and what we do, we will often tell ourselves and others that we're doing something that we don't really want to do, or not doing something that we really do want to do. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if someone's eating too much, they'll say, I don't really want to eat too much. I'm eating too much, but that's not what I really want to be doing. Or if they're not cleaning their house, they're saying, I really want to clean my house. I'm just not doing it. Do we ever say these things to ourselves or to other people? So these are all lies. Everything we're doing is motivated by some kind of rasa. Some looking for opulence and some looking for rasa. And we're much more likely to get our activities in harmony with our real self if we see what opulence and what rasa am I looking for, rather than denying that we're looking for something, because everything is motivated by this desire for pleasure. So we've gone through the opulences and the rasas. We know the main rasas. Everybody knows the main rasas, right? What are they?
Appreciation, servitorship, friendship, maternal love, and conjugal love.
Yes. So we may be interested in having a relationship of awe and reverence, a relationship of serving, a relationship of friendship, a relationship of guiding and helping and protecting, or a romantic relationship. So we're going to be motivated by some of the opulences, and we're going to be motivated by those. And then there's seven secondary relationships, seven secondary tastes. And we see a number of them here in this Leela of the Lord. So one is chivalry. There's a taste of sportsmanship, of the good, righteous fight. Right? And this is exhibited when we play games with people. You're playing Scrabble, or you're playing tennis, or, you know, whatever. There's some enjoyment of the chivalry. But it's the heroic fight, chivalry. And then there's the rasa of anger. Anger has a taste. Yes? There's a rasa of fear. You may say, well, these don't sound very enjoyable. But people do things to experience anger. When people have a protest march against the government or against some company, why are they doing that? To experience the rasa of anger. That's what's motivating them. And also looking for the opulence, probably, of wealth. What about fear? Anybody ever watch, does anyone in the world ever watch scary movies and pay money for it? Why do they do that? Because there's some rasa. Why do people go on amusement park rides or bungee jump off of buildings or something like that, you know? I mean, why do people do those sort of things? Because they want to experience the rasa of fear. There's a ghastly rasa. Prabhupada says if you want to experience the ghastly rasa with Krishna, you should worship the Singhadeva. Ghastly rasa, people who watch, you know, horror movies. Or Prabhupada says the murderer is trying to experience the ghastly rasa. I'm sure that part of the motive for meat eating is to experience a ghastly rasa. And previously in this fight with Jarasandha, it was very ghastly. I mean, rivers of blood are pretty ghastly. That's not just chivalry, that's ghastly. And body parts floating in the rivers, you know. What's your response? Isn't it? Isn't that a response? And we also try to enjoy the ghastly rasa if anybody says, "Ew, this is awful," and we say, "Oh, let me see." You know, it's ghastly. Rasa. And then the rasa of comedy. So comedy is anything having to do with joy. Generally, we think of pleasure as all this comedy rasa. Joyfulness. You know, if you have a picnic with your friends, so that's that rasa. But we see there's so many different tastes. Then there's the rasa of wonder, which is a little different than the shantarasa. Shantarasa is adoration. Shantarasa is the rasa you feel when you see your movie star or something like that. You know, your political leader, and you go, "Oh, my." You know, but this wonder is a little different. This wonder is more surprise, curiosity, excitement, thrill. And then there's compassion, karuna rasa. So, you know, this is also grief. And again, you may say, how is that enjoyable? And again, we give the example. People see sad movies, and they enjoy them. They pay for it. The reviewers say, this is a very sad movie, and oh, let me go. Was it a good movie? Oh yeah, I cried a lot. You know, that there's some pleasure in that. If you read this story, it will move you to tears. Oh, let me read it. So everything we're doing is motivated by some combination of these, by some combination of looking for these six opulences and some combination of looking for these 12 rasas. Everything we do, everything we think, everything we say, everything we do, we are looking for this. That's all we are looking for. We are not looking for anything else. So how can the absolute truth be without opulences and without rasa? You'll note that even though we're looking for these things, we don't find them very well on a material level. Do we find absolute strength materially? Absolute strength, total vigor and health and vitality. Anybody find that? No. Everyone talks about wellness and health, but is anybody absolutely well? And do you keep it? And there's always some other strength more powerful. I was just reading how Arjuna was talking about how Bhima had the strength of 10,000 elephants, but now that Krishna is gone, his strength is diminished. Well, we talked about beauty. So some devotees sent me some video showing how the models and the advertisements, their bodies are manipulated through Photoshop to look in a way that no human female actually is possible to look like. Or they've said, you know, these Barbie dolls, the proportions of the Barbie dolls are impossible for a human female to achieve. It's just, they're not real. So, but why do we have this desire for it? Why do we have this desire for a strength that's unachievable and this desire for a beauty that's unachievable? Why don't we just have real photos of real women on the magazines and everybody's satisfied with that? You know, even renunciation, Here he's talking about Krishna's home renounced. Is it possible to be totally renounced? There'll always be some attachment to something. Even when we'll be attached to one's own salvation, or when we'll be attached to one's own renunciation. That was the problem with Sudama Brahmana. The acharyas say the reason that Krishna gave Sudama Brahmana a palace is that he was attached to his renunciation. Some pride. Oh, I'm so renounced. So we don't find these things in perfection. We're looking for them. We don't find perfect happiness in a sad movie. We don't find perfect happiness in a roller coaster. Whatever we're doing, we certainly don't find perfect happiness in our friendships, in our romantic relationships, in our parental relationships. Anybody have a perfect relationship with their parents? You do.
Yeah, they're deceased.
Oh, well, there you go. Hare Krishna. So, we're looking for it. We have these, you know, idealized forms. We have these paintings of the mother and child. Oh, but that's not the reality, my dear friends. Most of us have, you know, contradictory and ambivalent feelings about our mother. And most mothers have somewhat contradictory and ambivalent feelings about their grown children, or even their little children. You know, there's the romantic ideal in the Disney movie of princess and the prince charming, and and they happily ever after. But that's not the reality, is it? It's not. You know, so the materialist will say, well, I guess it's as good as it gets. But why are we looking for something that's better than what we can achieve, is my point. Why aren't we just satisfied? Why don't we just say, oh, that's as good as it gets? We're not. We want to be in a situation of unlimited beauty, unlimited wealth, unlimited strength, unlimited renunciation, unlimited wisdom, unlimited fame. We want to have perfect enjoyment of comedy and chivalry and ghastliness and anger and fear. We want it to be, but we're not getting it. It's like when you go to a store and you want something and they don't have it, but you still want it. It's not that your desire dissipates just because the store doesn't have it. Everyone experiences this? Do we all want something that, like, doesn't exist? I want a suitcase that doesn't exist. I even wrote to some suitcase companies, this is the kind of suitcase you should make. But it doesn't exist. But the fact that it doesn't exist hasn't taken away my desire for it. Does that make sense to everybody? People will say, well, you can't really be that beautiful. Or you can't even really see a person who's that beautiful. You'll travel the whole world and you'll never see anyone as beautiful as the model on the magazine, even if you meet the model of the magazine, because she doesn't really look like that. But that doesn't take away our desire for it. Why? Because it exists somewhere. The fact that we have these desires that cannot be fulfilled materially, to me, is very strong evidence that God must be a person and he must be Akhila Rasamrita Murti. He must be the source of all of these things. Otherwise, why would we? And we all have that desire. It's not that only I have that desire. It's not that only I have the desire to see unlimited beauty and experience unlimited wealth. Don't you all have that desire? Doesn't everybody want to be just strong and healthy without any difficulty? Anybody want to be weak? So, therefore, our philosophy is so satisfying. Unfortunately, our execution of it may not always be so satisfying. Our presentation of it may not always be so satisfying. The way we organize our society to help everybody achieve it may not always be so satisfying. That's unfortunate. And what's even more unfortunate is that sometimes people stop going for the beautiful philosophy because of the faults of the aspiring devotees, or the faults of the society of the aspiring devotees. So I meet people all the time who say, well, I really like Krishna consciousness, but I don't know if I can hang out with the devotees. So whatever the faults are in our Hare Krishna movement, and we could elucidate them for a very long time, and whatever the faults are in me, because the Hare Krishna movement is made up of people like, including me, you know, whatever our faults are, and they're, at least my faults are numerous. Krishna is wonderful. Who wouldn't want to enter these pastimes of play? They're so much more wonderful than just this idea of God as the power, or the force, or the light. Krishna likes to play. He's always a young boy. So none of us, at least sitting in this room, are young. I don't see anybody here's like 15. But Krishna's eternally 15 years old. So I hope we can remember what it was like to be 15. Or maybe we know some 15-year-olds. He has the mood of a young boy. It's not just that he looks young. You see Kalachandra, I mean, it looks like he's just about to jump off the altar and start dancing down the temple room, and only Radharani is sort of restraining him. You know, he has this mood. He's a young boy. He likes to do fun things. He likes to play, and he likes to experience all these rasas and all these opulences. Sometimes he wants to experience his opulence of strength and just destroy the whole army and make a ghastly river of blood and show his chivalry. And other times he wants to enjoy his renunciation. I really don't care. Who cares? Let the stupid demon think he's great. Who cares? I've already defeated him 17 times. I don't really need to prove anything to anybody anymore. Let him just think he's great. Do we sometimes think like that? Somebody's railing against us. We're like, let them rail. Whatever. We just walk away. Sometimes we'll fight. You, liar, you. And sometimes we're like, say whatever you want about me. Do whatever you want, I don't care. Isn't that a nice feeling? Just go. And if you really don't care, if you're not just saying that out of bitterness, but if you just like really don't care, go ahead. Try to hurt me, I don't care. You can't hurt me. That's also Krishna Balaram, like, you can't hurt us. This is so silly. Bring your whole army after us when we're just walking on foot. Go ahead. Look for us. Go ahead. Burn down the mountain. We'll do whatever you want to do. We don't care. We have so many more important things to do than to fight with you. Like kidnap a princess. We'd much rather go kidnap a princess than fight with you again. We've already fought with you 17 times. I know we have plans for you later on with Bhima. We'll take care of you later. That's enjoyable. And it doesn't always follow the path of just ordinary materialistic persons. The materialistic king is, well, I have to fight every time someone challenges me. Anybody who's really in Rajaguna will be like that. Anyone who's in Rajaguna, they just can't walk away from a fight, ever. Because Rajaguna is a lot about reputation. If I walk away from this fight, my reputation will be spoiled. And Krishna's like, I don't care. I'm already unlimitedly famous. Why should I care? Because some demons criticize me. And in fact, this Prabhupada points out, Krishna becomes famous for walking away from the battlefield. He becomes worshipped for that. Maybe somebody criticizes him, but generally Krishna becomes worship for them. So if we recognize why we're really doing what we're doing, to be honest with ourselves, param sattvam dimhi, I meditate on the supreme absolute truth. Prabhupada says, in order to enter into fire, one must be like fire. If we want to enter into the truth, we need to be truthful. And that's the last leg of Kali, but even that, the bull's like shaken on it, you know. Most of us, I think, are not as truthful as we'd like to be. So this, of course, is being truthful with ourselves, and one of the defects of the conditioned soul is cheating ourselves. So be truthful with ourselves. If we're doing something we don't want to be doing, we say we don't want to be doing, or we're not doing something we say we want to be doing, look at it and say, what am I trying to get out of this? What opulence or what rasa or what combination of opulences and rasa am I trying to get out of doing this? What is it doing for me? And only when we do that can we see that it's not doing it for me. And only then can we become detached from it and do what we really want to do. As long as we say, well, I don't really want this, I'm not really this kind of person, you can't get rid of it because you're not being honest. It just doesn't work. And then we wonder, why do we have these problems that just like don't go away? Or we think they go away and then they come back. So it's a question of what rasa am I trying to enjoy? Am I trying to enjoy the ghastly rasa? That's a rasa, my friends. Am I trying to enjoy the anger rasa? That's also a rasa. What's driving me? And then ask, am I really enjoying this? And the answer will always be no. Okay, if I really want to enjoy this, why don't I find it in Krishna? Kila Rasa Mrita Murti, he's got everything. Krishna doesn't just have, you know, the king on the throne. It's not his only enjoyment. Krishna has all these, he has this enjoyment of renunciation. You know, I don't care, enjoyment. Think what you want about me. Do what you want to me. I don't care. I have something more important to do than bother with you. He has that. Look for it in Krishna. If we look for it in Krishna, the taste we get from Krishna is so exciting and so wonderful that naturally when we look at our own struggles, we'll say, I'm not getting any rust or any opulence out of that compared to what I'm getting from Krishna. And it will immediately become distasteful without any extraneous effort and without any exercise of willpower. Exactly like if any of us were meat eaters before. We get the same taste, or if not much better, in Krishna prasadam. And then there's no effort to give up meat eating. And I've met some. Not very many people who were former meat eaters who found that to be very difficult after getting Krishna prasadam. Now, most devotees don't drive by McDonald's and have some sort of difficulty controlling themselves. But it should be like that with any rasa and any opulence to which we're attracted. But first of all, you have to admit what you're attracted to. Otherwise, you can't go for the real thing. Is that logical for everybody? If I think I'm doing this for no good purpose, I'm doing this just because I'm an idiot, you won't be able to go for the real thing because you won't know what real thing you're looking for. But if you see, what am I looking for here? Maybe I'm looking for Karuna Rasa. Maybe I just want to feel grief all the time. So feel grief for Krishna. Feel grief for Radharani, who's left in Vrindavan for so many years. That's grief. Feel grief for Krishna in the coils of Kaliya. That's grief. Whatever we're feeling, like someone was talking to me the other day about how they're separated from their child. And I miss my child so much. If we think Krishna, this grief, that's Karuna Ras. Karuna Ras and Vatsalya Ras mixed. One thing, this enjoyment that I'm getting of mixing Karanto Ras and grief Ras, I can feel that for Krishna. If you even just say, Krishna, this enjoyment is really meant to be had in relationship to you. Even anger, even when you get angry at someone, generally we just feel ashamed and we just try to repress the anger. Oh, I shouldn't feel angry. Trivinam narakashinam dwaram nasanam adhanakam krodas tatalobas tasmare tuat tayam tajet. Shouldn't feel angry. Stop the anger. Stop it. But instead, oh, I'm enjoying feeling this anger. Let me feel anger for Krishna. Or even, I wish I could feel this anger in relation to Krishna. Even that, it works instantly. Instantly. When you're feeling angry, oh, I'm trying to enjoy anger rasa. I wish I could enjoy this anger rasa in relationship with you, Krishna. That's where this rasa is really meant to be enjoyed. Even just saying, I wish, it immediately dissipates the material perversion of the rasa. Immediately. Instantly. Because then you're like, oh, that's what it's for. But if you say, well, I don't really want to be, I don't really want to be angry, I don't want to, yes, you do. You can be angry at the demons. You can be angry at all the cows that are being slaughtered and all the babies that are being aborted and all the people being raised to say that there's no God. And in that anger, you can go grab some Bhagavad Gitas and run out the door and distribute them. You can be angry at the people who say that God is just a white light. You can be angry at, you know, Trinavarta, even if you're on that level. So this is where we want to go. It's very practical. This is Krishna consciousness is very attractive, and it's also very practical. You know, everybody talks about values, 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 values. Character, 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 character. But they can't do it, can they? They can't do it. All their lessons about being honest and being responsible and blah, 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 blah. And who can do it 100%? Who can be always a person of integrity 100% of the time? There's all these embarrassing failures. Today I'm going to be a person of integrity. Does it work? Does it work? Does it work?
No.
No. Anybody here always live up to their ideals? Please raise your hand if you always live up to all of your ideals. All your dreams. My idealized Romila way up there in the sky. The Urmila I want to be, way up there. Hi, Urmila. Hi, perfect Urmila. Oh, no, I got this one. It can't be done artificially. It can't be done just with willpower. It can't be just done just by reading some inspiring stories about some brave and truthful person. I mean, that's nice. It's not that like there's anything wrong with that, but it's not sufficient. It's not sufficient. It can only be done by transferring our attachment to Krishna. It's the only cure. It's the only ultimate, total, absolute cure. To get all of our desires satisfied in relationship to Krishna. Krishna consciousness is not about killing desires. It's not about denying desires. It's not about killing rasa. Surrender doesn't mean that you're miserable. Surrender doesn't mean you're not enjoying any kind of rasa and you're just doing things you hate. Surrender means that you're getting all your rasa, all of our desire for opulence and rasa in relationship to pleasing Krishna. And that's what surrender means. And that's our cure. And then one is so fully satisfied that the material perversion of rasa, where I think I'm Krishna, becomes ludicrous. It's just ludicrous. It becomes absurd. It just becomes foolish. Look at it and go, why would I want to do that? If you have a real pearl necklace, why would you want little balls of plastic? You don't need any willpower for that. If you have fresh squeezed orange juice from oranges grown organically and picked ripe, tree ripened from your backyard, why would you buy the orange juice from concentrate? It's not a struggle. You're not fighting with yourself. I don't know if I can drink this fresh squeezed orange juice right from my tree when I have the concentrate right next to it. Or what to speak of, not even concentrate, it's just chemical, you know, the those bottles of just full of, you know, water, sugar, dye, artificial flavor, 1% real juice. Sometimes we even serve that stuff in our temples. So would you drink that if you had your own orange tree in your own backyard and you picked the oranges fresh and you disclosed them? Would you drink the 1% juice with the dye in it? Would you be attracted? Would you even think about it? But first one has to say, why am I drinking the chemical 1% juice? What rasa am I looking for? Because then only then can you look for the real thing. So we should become absorbed in these pastimes, wonderful pastimes. How funny. This is so funny. And Krishna's just tricking the demons yet again. Pretending to be tired and climbing a mountain. So questions, comments? Yes.
Mike, thanks for another wonderful class. My question has to do with actually accepting Krishna for what you say he is. In other words, just like in this description, there's a description.
My question is about accepting Krishna for what you say he is. Just like, for example, in the story, we have a description of an 8-mile-high mountain.
Oh no, the mountain isn't 8 miles high. He jumped 8 miles.
Okay, so but even
so, that's the mountain and the flat altogether. He jumped 8 miles. Okay. From the mountain to his destination.
But today that mountain doesn't even exist where this is described.
Well, it's 5,000 years ago. All kinds of things don't exist anymore.
How could a huge mountain just vanish like that?
Happens all the time. Continents move. I mean, come on, even the scientists will tell you that. That mountain ranges form and fall and continents move. I mean, that's... Even atheists will tell you that. That's not a big thing.
But again, accepting your argument, but my question again has to do with, you're describing Krishna as this ideal person, that nobody really sees. I mean, if Krishna is here and he's all attractive, but if a beautiful model walks in here, everybody starts looking at her. It's like there seems to be some disconnect between your description of Krishna and the reality that people are experiencing. Otherwise, people would come to this temple and they'd be, wow, Krishna. Just like we had this reporter from Fox News, she came in here for the morning program, and at the end of the program, she said it was so boring. She said, to see you guys, she said it's like watching ghosts coming here in the morning, floating up the street at 4:30 in the morning, and then sitting here and chanting like that. She said, it's just so boring.
And so I remember one devotee saying, if you took materialistic people to Vaikuntha, they'd say, oh, it's just a bunch of Hare Krishnas, let's go home.
But this is my argument. You see, this is my question to you. In other words, how are you going to actually present this? Okay, we can dream about Krishna, we can hear a story about Krishna, but what factual experience are you offering us?
But you have to be open to the experience. That's true with everything. That's true even with material experiences. What they call the party pooper, the wet blanket. You can have a wonderful party and somebody can be sitting there going, oh, I'm so bored. I mean, that's always true. The person has to be open to the experience. As they surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. We all see from our perspective. You can't force an inner experience on somebody. So to have the inner experience of Krishna consciousness, you have to be somewhat open to it. I didn't feel that way when I first went to Mangalarti, way back when, almost 41 years ago. As soon as I went to one Mangalarti, I said, I'm joining this movement. Now, I mean, it could be our responsibility too. Sometimes we're not very good representatives of Krishna. I mean, that's a fact. Sometimes we don't behave properly. But Arvinda Sufu would tell the story of when Ramakrishna Maharaj and Vishnudanand Maharaj were traveling in their bus, and they would go to a place, and Vishnudanand Swami would have kirtan, and Ramakrishna Maharaj would give a lecture, and they'd pass out prasadam. And then Ramakrishna Maharaj would go around talking to people. And Arvinda Sufu said, "How do you decide which people to spend time with?" He said, "Well, I go around and I say to them, do you like the music? You like the food?" And if they said, "Yeah," then he would talk to them. And if they say, "Oh, it's all right," then he would ignore them. So Arvinda Prabhu said he decided to test this. So after the kirtan and the lecture and the prasad, he went around and met one guy. "You like the music? Yeah, it's okay. You like the food? Yeah, it's okay." And he sat down and started discussing philosophy with him. And after about an hour, the man said, "Yeah, that's all very logical. I agree with everything you said." So Arvinda said, "So would you like to join us?" "No, I don't think so." So I think you're hitting the perennial question of why do some people take up Krishna consciousness and some people don't. I mean, to some extent, it's our responsibility. To some extent, we can say it's how we present Krishna consciousness. If people were in Mangalarti, just, I don't know, I wasn't there that day. We do have some responsibility. Like a store may have a wonderful product, but if the salespeople in the store don't know anything about the product or treat you badly, you may not buy that product, even though it may be a wonderful product that would perfectly suit your needs. We've all had this experience. Later we find, I should have bought that, it would have been perfect, but we were so put off by the salespeople. So some of it's us. But the other thing is that different people have different desires. Krishna fulfills everyone's desires. Manusinam sasri sukhashri gyanati sidayatitam apisidanam kashchimam peti tatvitam. And as far as everybody would look at the beautiful model instead of Krishna, I don't think that's true. We had one devotee joined in Europe who was a Vogue cover girl, as beautiful as they get, not as beautiful as in the Photoshop picture, but as beautiful as they get in real life. And it's not that everybody in the kirtan stopped looking at the deities and was just looking at her. I haven't seen that to be the case. I mean, maybe some man who really should get married and is artificially not getting married will do that. And then we look naturally, we look at someone who's beautiful. Everybody looks at someone who's beautiful. Normal. That's just normal. Of course we do. But are we going to stare and be totally enamored instead of Krishna? And then there's something wrong. There's something wrong with that. I mean, if somebody amazing and beautiful walked to the door, of course everybody would look at them. That's just normal. I was giving a class in London some months ago, all women. And one of the girls in front of me was strikingly beautiful. It was like amazingly, one in 10 million kind of beautiful. And it was hard not to look at her because she was so beautiful. It was difficult. I did intentionally not stare at her. I can't even imagine what it would be like for a man. I imagine for the men they'd have car accidents. And I asked her fiancé, I said, when you go out with your fiancé, does everybody you walk by stare at her? He says, "Oh, yeah." I says, "Have you ever been in a car accident?" He says, "Some pretty close ones." But it wasn't that we all lost our interest in Krishna just because there was some beautiful girl in the room. Then there's something wrong with your own inner life. And more, that you can understand that the fact that we naturally want to stare at something that's beautiful is simply indicative that what we really want is Krishna. I mean, she wasn't that beautiful. She wasn't as beautiful as Krishna. She wasn't as beautiful that you just like faint. And go, "Oh my God!" It wasn't like that. And she was about as good as it gets. But it wasn't like that. It wasn't like, what's described when people see Krishna, where they faint. And they just see his toenail and they faint. Just one toenail of Krishna is so beautiful that the people can't stop staring at Krishna's toenail. So she wasn't that beautiful. But there's some indication, you know, we're all attracted to beauty, we're all attracted to wealth, we're all attracted to strength, we're all attracted to renunciation. Of course we are. It'd be weird if we weren't. The fact that we're attracted to that means that ultimately we're looking for Krishna. Srila Prabhupada noticed when somebody was beautiful. It wasn't that he didn't notice. Does that make sense? Of course he knows. We're not stones. We notice if someone's very intelligent. We notice if somebody's very strong. Of course. We're looking for Krishna. But I haven't seen that. I haven't seen in temples where there's some particularly beautiful person that everybody stops looking at in the kirtans, nobody looks at the deity anymore. I haven't seen that. Or some very handsome man, or it's not that everyone in the temple is just... I remember also I was shopping in Germany and there was one person working in the store, one man who was, again, extremely good-looking, just like one of those very rare persons. And I mean, whoa! But it's not that... Okay, let me leave the temple and just go stand in the store and stare at him. You know, he wasn't that. I can stare at the same Krishna every day for hours. I don't think I could have stared at that guy for more than like a couple of minutes. Does that make sense? Have you ever seen that in kirtan? That all of a sudden in the kirtan, that all of a sudden everybody stops looking at the deity and they're just like... I haven't seen that. I hope that answers your question.
Sure. I mean, I'm kind of playing a devil's advocate here, and I wanted to, you know, create some controversy for you to address.
Oh, thanks.
But at the same time, going out and spreading Krishna consciousness, you're constantly confronted with that. You're constantly confronted with the competition that's being offered.
But nobody's satisfied with the competition. That's why there's all these fictional characters. Why, you know, why the Superman and the... If we're really satisfied with the real heroes, why do we have Superman and Batman and whatever man? We're not satisfied. The competition stinks. We're not satisfied. You know, you can stare at the beautiful woman for, you know, an hour, but you're not going to stare at that beautiful woman hour after hour after hour, even if you marry her. Eventually, she's just your wife, and you forget how beautiful she is most of the time. Yes? It gets boring. Do you ever feel bored seeing Kalachandri? Yeah, I've seen it before. What's the competition? It's like this place is very beautiful, but if you live here, probably you're just kind of, oh, yeah. So there isn't any competition. The only competition is fictional. Real life is very boring. There's not much of any of these rusts in our real lives, is there? Most of our real lives are very dry materially, yes? Anybody have a life that's full of chivalry and fear and adventure and wonder and comedy? And no, most people get up, they brush their teeth, they take a shower, they use the toilet, they drive in their car, they go to work, they eat a sandwich, they come home, they watch the football game. Where's the competition? You have to invent it. You have to invent some fictional character who can jump off of buildings and like Krishna jumping off a mountain. You have to create it fictionally to have any kind of competition. You have to, you know, Photoshop the ladies and you have to Photoshop the men. And what do they have now? The computer generated characters? I forget what they're called.
Sims.
where it's not the real people. You know, they have a real actor and then they put some things on them and then they create a computer generated
animation.
Talk about the animation.
It's called Sims, S-I-M-S.
Okay.
They're the reality.
Yeah, that's the only way you can compete, and even that's not satisfying. After you see your Superman movie or your Batman movie or whatever, you know, in the Photoshop, heavily made up actress and whatever, do you feel fully satisfied? Can you watch the movie a million times? Are all your desires completely fulfilled with the fiction? What's the competition? I don't see any competition. But if you don't want to surrender to Krishna, then that's what you'll do. You know what I mean? If somebody's buying the 1% chemically colored, chemically flavored juice, somebody's buying it. Somebody's saying, I'd rather have this. Okay. Somebody else. Is there anybody else? Yes, please.
So, Ramanujacharya was with his disciples at a festival, kind of like a Rathiatra festival, and they noticed this wrestler, this big man, and he was with this beautiful woman, and he had an umbrella over her head, and he was fanning her. And they were a little offended that he was just engrossed, this woman, not even interested in the festival at all. She had come for the festival. And so Ramanuja told his disciples to go ask, why is this man so engrossed? And his remark was that if he could show him somebody more beautiful, he would give up his attachment. And so Ramanuja arranged for him to go see Sri Ranganath, see the beautiful eyes of Sri Ranganath. And the man gave up his attachment to this woman. And the woman actually was a Vaishnava, so when she saw that he had become purified in that way, she became attracted to him and got married.
Yes, very nice story. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Mother Gayatri.
That was Vaishnava's key, Jerry.